So we'll consider the theory, the Kruskal-Novell model with On symmetry and this Lagrangian. And I'll introduce a coupling constant, G, with this normalization. We have this usual quartic term where we sum over repeated indices. So you notice that this model has a Z mod 2 symmetry. Where the chiral fields change sign, but the antichiral fields stay the same. Now, it turns out that this Z mod 2 symmetry would forbid a mass, because a mass term is would be of the form psi I psi bar I. This term is not Z mod 2 symmetric. So at first sight, it looks like no matter what you do, we're never going to, no matter what we do that preserves that Z mod 2 symmetry, we will have a massless theory. But the claim of Kruskal-Novell is that as n goes to infinity, the Z mod 2 symmetry is spontaneously broken. And spontaneously broken, of course, means that the theory itself has Z mod 2 symmetry, but the vacuum does not. That in this vacuum, the theory is massive. So this is a lot like the Higgs mechanism. So as we do the analysis, we'll find there's some scalar which built from the fermions, some composite of the fermions, and that scalar has an effective potential, and the lowest points in this potential are not Z mod 2 symmetric, so that in the vacuum the scalar is not at the Z mod 2 symmetric point, and this will introduce a mass. It's a lot like the Higgs mechanism, but somehow it's nicer, because in the Higgs mechanism, you just by hand write down a potential. Whereas here, we start with this Lagrangian, which doesn't have a potential at all, so the potential is generated dynamically from the large N analysis. Okay, so the first step to understand this, we'll introduce an auxiliary field. And we'll rewrite the Lagrangian as the usual kinetic term. Plus n sigma some psi I psi bar I I'm not gonna worry too much about the coupling. So we can do the usual trick we've seen before of completing the square. Sending sigma to some kind of transformation of this form. We get the previous Lagrangian plus sigma squared. So you can think of this alternatively. We can integrate out sigma and the propagator is a delta function because the sigma has no kinetic term the way it's written, so the propagator is just a delta function times g over n. And then if you think of this vertex, psi bar sigma psi bar sigma, that vertex will produce exactly that interaction. This is g over n. This will give g over n and probably I got a sign or a factor wrong, probably, so I'm worried too much about that. So all we've done so far is we write the same Lagrangian in a slightly different form. Now notice that the Z mod 2 symmetry we had before sends sigma to minus sigma. So what we'll find is that this scalar field sigma is what will get a potential. And the vacuum will be a state where sigma is not zero. So let me write that out before doing the analysis, just so it's clear that this will be what happens. So we'll find that in the lowest energy state, the expectation value of sigma is not zero. It's some constant C, so that we can write sigma as C plus some perturbation of that guy. And if we reintroduce this into the Lagrangian, so now perturbing around sigma equals C, so that's sigma naught equals zero, the Lagrangian will get, it will explicitly see a mass for the fermionic fields. and it'll clear the term. C sum psi bar I. So these fields psi bar I have a mass. Okay, so we have to understand how to figure out whether we're in the ground state or not. So we can start by asking, we're going to work in Lorentzian signature, and we'll take our space direction to be periodic. So we have T, we're going to work on a cylinder. So to talk about a state at negative infinity and positive infinity, we need to say prescribing a state is the same as prescribing the asymptotics of our fields at positive and negative infinity for the path integral. So the most naive state, which is Z mod 2 symmetric, is the one where sigma goes to infinity, sorry, sigma goes to zero at t equals plus or minus infinity. So there's other states where sigma goes to C at t equals minus infinity. So call this state C. And suppose we can try to calculate, for example, we might want to calculate the transition amplitude from one state to the other . I take C1 at negative infinity, well, not infinity, some finite large but finite distance, e to the minus t of the Hamiltonian. C2, this transition amplitude as t goes to infinity is equal to the path integral where sigma goes to C1 at minus infinity, C2 at a plus infinity of e to the Lagrangian sigma. Does anybody have any questions about this interpretation of these states? Okay, so.
Question?
Yeah.
When we do the perturbation, we'll get a term, mass term. Where is it that we took n to infinity there?
Oh, well, we'll see this in a minute. When we try to calculate these transition amplitudes, for finite n, it's going to be a total mess, and we won't be able to do it. But at n equals infinity, the calculation will be very simple, and we'll see explicitly. At least, it won't be very simple. It will be easier, and we might not get to the end of it. But you'll see that it's there's a finite number of some simple Feynman diagrams. This will be very manageable. Okay, so in particular, so if the eigenvalue, the energy of the state C is, say, W of C, then C, this quantity is like E to the minus T W C. So it's like the path integral so the path integral where sigma goes to C at plus and minus infinity measures the energy of the state C. More precisely, if we want to figure out what this function W is, we should take the logarithm. So let's now take this expression here and write it out in terms of Feynman diagrams, and we'll find a general kind of formal expression for this function. Of course, what we want to do to find the actual vacuum will be to minimize this function. So the logarithm of the path integral well, if we just took the path integral, we'd get a sum over all Feynman diagrams, but because we're taking the logarithm, well, let's see how to understand this. We can think of this as the integral sigma to 0 at plus or minus infinity, where I shift Lagrangian C. Now, because we're not taking the expectation values of any operators or anything like that, this would normally be a sum over connect over diagrams with no external lines, but because this sigma has been shifted, like we're doing it, we're perturbing around a background where sigma has some constant value, this is going to be the sum over connected diagrams with external lines at which we place constant sigma. So there's going to be some number. It's going to be some large sum over Feynman diagrams, and on some these external lines, we're going to place this constant value of sigma. And this is the quantity we're going to have to compute to figure out this function W, which is the effective potential. Let's see. So one small point, if that blackboard is visible despite the glare, you can see that W is 1 over T times something. Well, that 1 over T arises because when we have these connected diagrams, the integral will involve an integral over space-time, which will diverge because the amplitude is translation invariant. So that 1 over T is effectively just dividing by the volume of space-time. So when we do these integrals, we're going to fix one of the vertices to be at a particular point and then integrate over the other vertices. OK, so let me now explain the Feynman, how the Feynman rules work and how the 1 over n, the large n analysis, simplifies these calculations. So I'll use a dotted line for sigma, straight line for psi, and psi bar. The sigma propagator comes with 1 over n. Because there was an n sigma squared in the Lagrangian. I think the Lagrangian has been erased. I just erased it. So the other vertices do not come with a factor of n. Okay, so let's compute the coefficient of n in front of every diagram. And then we'll isolate just the leading term.
There should be a g, 1 over g in the last term?
Or? Yes. I forgot it. Yes. So, well, there's this vertex. This, of course, is n over g. And this will contribute to the integral when sigma equals c at infinity. It will just contribute c squared. This one is kind of trivial. So next, I can imagine something like this. Where I have a bunch of external sigma fields and these fermions going around in a circle. Now, so what's the contribution of this? There are n fermions. So we're taking the trace over an n-dimensional vector space. So this contributes n, something of order n. So let's think about what more complicated diagrams one might have. For instance, you could have two of these guys connected by a sigma propagator. So the contribution of this guy, there will be an n there, a 1 over n there, and an n there. So this thing has something of contributes something of order n. Now, let's see. So we notice, just before we work down the other diagrams, that we're not allowed to have these undashed lines being external lines. They must be closed up. The only way to do that is if they're closed up into a loop like this. So the most general diagram consists of things where, like, the vertices of these loops, and they're connected by sigma propagators. So let's look at the next most complicated one, and we'll find that it will not contribute. So something like this I want to make this kind of thing. So where there's a loop built of sigma propagators, where the analog of the vertices are these inner loops built of psi propagators, so we count the factors of n. So there's an n for each circle, like that, 1 over n for each sigma propagator. Of course, they're the same number of those guys. There's 3 each. So we find this is of order n to the 0. So continuing this analysis, we find that the most general order n diagram is going to be a tree. Whose vertices are wheels like this. And the edges are the sigma propagators. Okay, and then the more complicated diagrams, which look like more complicated graphs, are going to be contributing something of order n to the zero are negative order in n. Okay, any questions about that?
If the edges are sigma propagators, then the more sigmas we have, the more the graph will dominate.
Because of the coupling?
Should we not associate this with the, every sigma propagator comes with a 1 over n, right? So,
yes.
So the fewer, the more sigma propagators we attach, the more it's...
The more it's suppressed at large n, exactly. So that's why the more complicated graphs don't contribute.
Sorry?
That's why the more complicated graphs don't contribute. Okay. Now, so the next step in the analysis is to see that, you know, we have these trees built from these simpler pieces. We want to show that only these simpler pieces here with one loop of sigmas, only those will actually contribute. So at this point, some people it would say, oh, the other graphs are not one particle irreducible. I don't find that particularly convincing. So, but you can, I just want to show you that the other graphs are actually zero. So the trees with more than one vertex So for example, I'll give you an example that will the argument will generalize. Suppose we have something like this. Well, we're integrating. So here we have C at these either end, and we're integrating over sigma goes sigma naught plus c, where sigma naught goes to zero. I don't want to spend too much time on this. So for your Fourier transform, in the theta direction, you know, the constant mode is going to be absorbed into C. We have the non-constant modes. So the propagator is going to involve something involving the non-constant modes of theta. Involves something like E minus 2 pi n theta. So, and something like this. I'm sorry, this is going to probably not going to be understandable. So, what I get from one vertex contribution of the propagator is charged under rotation of theta, but the contribution of the rest of this diagram over here is uncharged. Except for this integral is just zero. As it's not invariant under rotation of theta. OK, so we've kind of sketched a slightly vague argument that the,
Can you repeat that last argument again? Sorry.
Right, the propagator is going to involve things which are on each leg are charged under rotation of theta. But these amplitudes here, because this field C is constant, this amplitude here is uncharged under rotation of theta. So therefore, the integral of this over the theta circle would be zero. OK, so we have this slightly sketchy argument for why we can ignore anything but the very simplest diagram. So let's finally compute.
So that diagram over there is zero, the one that you wrote?
The one, anything with an internal sigma propagator is zero. Including this one there and this one here. I claim, and I hope. The standard references really just gloss over this point and say we just ignore them. And I'm not entirely convinced, but I think they're just zero. So the next step is we'll compute the amplitudes for these diagrams. Okay, so to make things for simplicity, to make the formulas for these computations somewhat simpler, I mean, there's going to be problems with infrared divergences here. We have to choose some way of regularizing it. The way I want to do it is go back to Euclidean signature and work on a torus, make the two directions periodic. The torus is where we identify W under these translations. We'll also make our fermions. You know, when we have periodic boundary conditions for fermions, there's two choices. They can be periodic or antiperiodic. There's two ways of putting fermions in a circle. So we'll make them fermions antiperiodic. Under W to W plus 1. And periodic under W to W plus I. So, okay, with these conventions, we can write down our question.
I was going to ask what would be the physical significance of putting a periodic or antiperiodic boundary on the fermions?
Right, so fermionic fields can be defined on a space-time manifold with a spin structure. The circle has two spin structures. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Too abstract.
You're putting the periodic or the antiperiodic boundary condition in only the spatial directions, right?
Yes, I don't want to do it. I want to think of the periodic direction as time and the antiperiodic direction as space. But strictly speaking, because we've gone to Euclidean signature to simplify the analysis, that's a bit dubious. But so once we do this, what does the space of fields look like? Well, each chiral fermion can be expanded in Fourier modes. And similarly, sidebar. So we can just expand them as usual within the Fourier modes, where the ones for theta 1 are of an odd exponent, therefore they're antiperiodic. I must admit that with this calculation, we'll get a reasonable formula for the effective potential. And then there's some analysis I don't quite understand about how to make the torus very big. But I'll take as far as I can reasonably understand. So we should also note that the path integral one reason it's reasonable to have periodic boundary conditions is only over a non-constant fluctuations of sigma. So the picture I have in mind is this transition amplitude, because we have the same state at either end, this is the same as the amplitude on a torus, where I ask that the zero mode be C. Okay, so in this Fourier expansion, what do these diagrams look like? Well, and need to calculate the psi and psi bar propagators. So if we let F and M just introduce some notation for these Fourier modes, then del W bar FNM is equal to N plus IM del W, maybe that's zero minus, doesn't matter, is same thing with the offset sign. So the propagator, viewed as an operator in the space of fields for the psi guys, the psi propagator, is del W bar inverse, which is, which sends F and M to 1 over N minus I M. The psi bar propagator is del W inverse So a diagram like this one, where I have in this line I might have psi. If you remember, sigma couples to psi and psi bar, so therefore psi's and psi bars must alternate these diagrams. So this contributes the trace because it's in a loop, and then c to the fourth times the trace of del W bar inverse, del W inverse, del W bar inverse, del W inverse. And since we have this basis for this basis of fields, the FNM, this is sum and M C to the fourth. This guy is 1 over N minus I M, 1 over N plus I M. They come in pairs. And I find 1 over N squared plus M squared squared. Okay, so this is very like one simple amplitude, and we compute it in this way. Okay, any questions about this way of doing these Feminine computations? It's a really useful trick. Yeah. Okay, so the next step is, what happens if we sum up all of these diagrams? Well, one thing I neglected to mention here is that, as always when one computes Feynman diagrams, there's a symmetry factor. Here the symmetry factor is 2, because this diagram has a twofold symmetry. So this will give me a factor of 1/2. The diagram with 2 k vertices will give me a 1 over k symmetry factor. Okay, so summing up all diagrams, and including the n over gc squared factor that is in the classical Lagrangian, we get n over gc squared plus sum equal to 2k over n squared plus m squared k. Okay. Now, you might recognize this as the series expansion for log. Okay, so we've obtained our final form of the effective potential. And what we're supposed to do next is vary this with respect to C and find the minimum and plug that back into the Lagrangian to find the mass. This can be done with this regularization where I've put things on a torus. I think it gets a little painful. At least I didn't quite see how to do it to the end of it easily. The way it's done in the papers I've looked at, they didn't put it on a torus, but they introduced some explicit IO regulator. They played some games with that. But I'm not sure I really want to get into all those details. The main point of the analysis and the thing I hope you can take away is this really explicit method for spontaneous symmetry breaking and spontaneous mass generation, where you get an effective potential by some explicit calculations with Feynman diagrams. Okay. I'll stop there.
So the mass is the sigma field gets the mass, right?
Yes. No, so this is W of C. And you solve this equation, W prime C equals 0. And then you insert sigma equals sigma naught plus C, where C solves this equation. And because we have this sigma psi bar I term, this will give us a term like this. So the mass term for the fermions will be proportional to the value of the critical point of this function. One thing to note, again, the way we've done it, the critical point of this function will depend explicitly on the size of the torus. The size of the torus is the coupling constant. It's the energy scale. Because the theory has a beta function, scaling the torus is the same as scaling the coupling constant. Right, because if I introduced, if you want to make things periodic on a circle of some other radius, you would have e to the 2 pi I n theta over the radius. Right there. So n would get replaced by n over the radius. So this would be find a 1 over r squared appearing there. Yeah.
Sorry, this is kind of the symmetries of the torus, do those things play a role in generating something interesting?
Well, one of them is a Hamiltonian.
Sorry?
One symmetry is just time translation, so it's related to the Hamiltonian. The other is the other component of momentum.
Say that these diagrams were of order n because of the trace over all.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Sorry about that. That makes this much nicer because both terms have the same factor of n. Convergent when you have a, so if I take this sum when k is bigger than 1, those guys are absolutely convergent because you think of the Lorentz circle and think how many lattice points are going to be on the circle. It's about the radius. So this factor, it looks like the integral of 1 over to the k. But I think the one when k is 1 is not convergent. Has to be regularized, I think. Yeah, the very first term has a logarithmic divergence. That's another annoying feature. I didn't see it that until you mentioned it.